Corey, what's happening?
It's happening, bro.
There's this extra thing. It's like, no, I don't want the. That's what makes it tight. If somebody's playing and it's like, okay, it's like, hey, good job, man. You know you're never going to see that person again.
Your signature strat has this smaller body.
Right here.
How did you figure that out?
A hunch.
What was the session that you did for Blake Shelton?
Let me try to find it.
Oh, Corey, what's happening?
It's happening, bro.
Dude, way more guitars than I almost thought for some reason. You got a lot of guitars, man.
Don't come at me. Don't come at me, man. I know.
Oh, I'm jealous. I'm jealous. I'm not coming at you. I'm jealous.
It's the other folks in the house here that are always like, come on, why guitars everywhere? Yeah.
No. I get it. How are the, what'd you have, parent-teacher conferences?
Yeah. My daughter, my eighth grader, she's doing well. This is good.
Better than the alternative.
Absolutely.
I have this fantasy that, like, if I ever become a parent, I'm going to go into these parent-teacher conferences and I'm going to be, like, the cool musician parent. Like, I'm going to feel some, like, there's something cool about that. You're maybe the coolest parent that this teacher ever sees. Is that possible?
No, I got nothing to prove, dude. When I'm home, this is why I like living in Minneapolis, dude. It's not an industry town. It's like my neighbors don't even really know what I do. Cat's kind of not out of the bag yet. I moved into a newer house like a year ago.
Yeah.
And it's one of my neighbors knows what I do. The other one's just like, this cat guy next door went to Harvard. His daughter's at Harvard right now. They're just like, it's like, I'm a dope mechanical engineer or whatever. Like, you know, we're just doing our thing. You know, it's not like an industry. I like the industry towns. I get so much of the industry the other 170 days a year when I'm, you know, doing my thing or whatever it is. And it's nice to just come back somewhere where I don't have to like be the guy that's on, you know. I'm going to parent teacher conferences. It's like, yo, yeah, I'm dad. I'm showing up, you know,
but
I got nothing to prove.
Isn't there, but I feel like it's not about proving anything. Isn't there something about being the only industry guy in the town? Like, you're the guy at the school versus if you were in like Nashville, everyone would be a musician. Or do you not think like that?
I mean, the music teachers at the school know, but you know, it's just, I don't know. I'm just saying it's about my daughter, you know. I think she also, my kids appreciate being able to separate it, because so much of the time that we're out or something, people will come up and talk and it's just like about me, and I don't want their life experience to be through the lens of, oh, you're Corey's kids. It's like they have their own lives and I want them to be their own person, you know? So whatever. I don't know. Let them do their thing, you know?
Corey, I have to ask you, you just posted this video on your Instagram and I think I watched it like five times because it was very confusing to me. Did you really break your ankle by being lowered onto the stage? Was that a joke video or is that really?
You missed it, dude. If you weren't at the gig, you missed it, dude.
Wait. But why is this a secretive thing? Because I texted Jason Shadrick about this, a mutual friend. I said, is that really how Corey broke his ankle? And he said, I'll never say. Is this like a secret that you guys are trying to keep? Is that really how you injured yourself?
I messed up my leg at a festival. These are completely independent things. The whole thing that you're talking about, Tori. Oh, I'll get into it. Yeah, let's get into it.
Hold on. Are we not supposed to get into it? Is this like a secret or?
No. It's just fun. It's just fun. I feel bad because, okay, so I believe in entertainment along with musical excellence and art. I don't think the two need to be mutually exclusive, or the three. And I am always thinking about how can you entertain your audience? How can you give them a wow factor, or what's something special about this specific tour? And the future tours that I do, I want people to know I'm always going to come up with something new and exciting that is kind of a fingerprint of that tour. Oh, this is the tour where they did that thing. Oh, this is the tour where he did that thing. And I had this idea, like, I've always wanted to fly on the gig. I saw this video of the Katy Perry Prism tour, and she had the two guitar players like flying in the air on these harnesses, shredding guitar solos and stuff. I was like, that's so dope. I want that so bad. And it just, it would be so much fun. But the insurance is absolutely insane. And then to actually pull it off is, you know, it requires a lot, you know. And I'm a DIY guy. So I'm totally like, dude, let's put me in the harness and like, let's go High School Musical style. Like, I'm down. Like, I love my shows to feel the A-list pro, but at the same time, like, is this a high school production too? Because there's aspects of it that I think are fun and human, especially being an independent artist and just like playing mostly instrumental music. It's like, it's kind of fun to have aspects of it that feel a little bit homegrown or something, grassroots, just because that's me. That's my vibe. So I want to fly. I wanted to actually do it. My managers, I was like, look into the insurance. They're like, dude, it's hard. Like, you already have two buses, two trailers. We have, you know, $100,000 in rentals also in blah, 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 and all these other things on top of the bus and the hotels and the food. Touring is very expensive. It's like, if you were, it's already hard enough to make money on tour to really do it the right way. And if you want the insurance policy so you can fly in the air, so you can get lifted up, have two of your boys pulling on the pulley, like, it's going to take years for you to recoup the insurance alone.
Why do you need insurance, though? Is that because you feel like you need, who's saying that you need insurance? Is it
the venues?
The venues.
The venues, the promoters,
all of it. The venues won't let you fly unless...
I mean, oh, yeah, show up at the Ryman. They're like, oh, yeah, go ahead. Fly 40, 50 feet up in the air. We'll let you get on our like, they're like, no, you're not doing that. One of you is going to sue us. Somebody's going to, like, you know, whatever. So I'm like, all right, let's do this then. I'm going to get a mannequin and I'm going to dress it in my exact wardrobe. I'm going to put a real Stratocaster on the harness. And the mannequin basically was up through the whole, like, when doors hit and when the opening act was playing, the mannequin's way...
Right.
100 feet up so nobody can see it, right? And then when the top of the show starts, stage goes black, the rest of the band walks out, and I run behind and hide underneath the back risers in the exact same wardrobe as the mannequin and Strat. And I wrote this dramatic intro music, and then it's like, all right, let it down until it's like about 20 feet up, where it's believable enough that if I were to actually have fallen, I wouldn't have died, but something really bad would have happened. It's not the height where anybody would die, but somebody's definitely getting hurt if they fall from that level. So I'd have them drop it on this cue. And then as soon as the mannequin hits the ground, I bash the strings. So it makes this huge noise. And then I come stumbling out, like, and the stagehands are like, you know, coming over and kind of, are you okay? Are you okay? And then I get out to the front of the stage. I go, 1, 2, 3, 4. And then I just, boom, light on. And then I'm just full energy. So it was this dramatic thing where it was funny because about 50% of the audience
believed it.
And that's plenty. And more than 50% saw this Instagram video. This is a year and a half later now. And they're like, oh my gosh, dude, I can't believe you did this. Like, what is, like, my favorite comment is, why can't you just do drugs like a normal rock star? Like, why do you have to do these kind of antics? And it was a thing where it was just for the people that thought it was real, it was either shit that. I can't believe this, but clearly he's fine. Like, look, he's playing. And I kept asking all my friends who came to the show, did you believe it or not? And Eddie Barbash, this saxophone player, his mom was in the crowd the first time we did this. And afterwards he asked, hey mom, what did you think about Corey falling at the beginning? She's like, oh yeah, that looked like it hurt, but he's young enough. I'm sure he's fine. I just figured it hurt a little bit and he's going to be okay. And then other people were just like, dude, are you good, dude? Like, do we need to? And one of my friends who's a doctor was at the gig. I could see him in the audience. He's like, what? Bro. But
so you only did it one time? That's only
no, I did it.
Well, because not every venue could accommodate. So I probably did it at 7 or 8 shows, which I think added to the lore of it. Because I didn't do it at every show. So it's like, oh, he got hurt last time. So he must not have done it again.
That's the funniest thing ever.
So it actually all ended up being great. And it was fun. So I'm always trying to think of these different fun entertainment ideas to bring a wow factor, get the heart rate going at the show, you know?
I think the character of Corey Wong is like a very playful, very, I don't know if goofy is the right term. Like it doesn't take things too seriously. And then when I listen to interviews of you, or like I've watched like horror documentaries or all these things, you actually strike me as an incredibly serious person, especially when you're in the rehearsal room or when anything else is happening. do people ever come in and think like, oh, you're going to be funny and fun? And are they surprised that you're like, actually, my gut is that you're really, really,
is that I'm actually
really
not
serious.
Fun at all. I'm like a total dick.
No, it's not that. It's that this is all really serious. Like this is like, it is serious to get to the joke. Maybe.
Yes.
Like, I don't know if that's the best way to put it.
Totally.
Is that how you feel about it?
I mean, yes, I like to have fun. The thing is, a part of avoiding burnout for me is I say no to 90% of the things that come across my desk, as they say in the business world. And not just like, oh, anything I say no to doesn't sound like fun. It's just sometimes I know I'm not going to be able to put in the proper bandwidth to do it well with the proper amount of excellence that I want to bring to the table for it. Or two, I just don't have the time. Or sometimes just like, it's going to take too much for me to do it. It's not like, yes, it's a good business move, or it might be a good career move, or it's good optics or something, but it's like, it might suck more out of me than what I'll get from it. And the majority of what I do, I want it to be fun. I want it to be exciting. I want it to challenge me artistically. I want it to challenge my artistry, and just my musicality. So I have fun in all the things that I do, but and I don't take myself too seriously. But the things that I do take very seriously is the excellence in music, the artistry behind it, and the intentionality and focus. Are we just having fun, hanging out at the pub, throwing darts at the wall? Or are we actually throwing darts at a certain target? Today, we might be shooting at this place in the target. Tomorrow, right there. Or in the verse, we're shooting here. In the choruses, we're shooting here. So if we are aiming for something, I want to make sure that we're nailing the thing that we're doing. And some of that requires a very serious amount of focus and intention. And there's a lot of stuff that I am very serious about, because that's what you have to do to have a really tight band. And for things to not just be like, oh, it's just a bunch of jamming. I mean, I have like a 10-piece band, you know? So I do think some people come in, they're like, oh yeah, it'd be so fun to play saxophone or play bass or any whatever random instrument in Corey's band. Yes, but I am relentless when it comes to the attention to detail on certain things. The things that are highly arranged, they need to be, we all have our place in it because there's so many people involved. And then when it's open and we leave the jumping point, that place that's open, it's about intentionality and focus for what the moment is and following whoever is supposed to lead us on the journey in that. And if it's trumpet player taking us on a journey through their solo, it doesn't mean that everybody else in the band can kind of dick around behind it. It's like you have to be very focused to make sure don't draw attention away from the thing that's supposed to be the thing. And I think especially in instrumental music, a lot of folks that come to my shows, it might be the only instrumental show they ever go to that year. So it's like, let's make sure they really know what they're supposed to be listening to or focusing on or looking at. And let's be really intentional about delivering that to them in a way that's frictionless, you know? And it's not like, who am I supposed to be looking at right now? Because it's like the trumpet player's out here, but the drummer's doing all this stuff. The drummer better have a reason to do the stuff, or it better be something that's driving the journey that the trumpet player is taking us on in this case, or whatever. It's just an example. But you know, I am very serious about a lot of stuff. And yeah, I think some people might say, oh man, Corey's just like a bit of a, he's just really picky as a band leader. Oh, it's so, there's so much blah, 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 this and this. It's like, no, I'm particular. I'm not picky. I'm particular. And there's
what's
certain
the difference?
Things. Well, picky is just like, oh, I wanted this. Oh, I want this. Oh, I want this. Or oh, I don't like this. I don't like this. It's like, I'm open to anything if it feels like it fits the thing and if it's intentional. And I'm particular about certain things. It's like, I am not picky about the fact that we need to cut off on the and of four. You are cutting off on the of four. And what's happening is everything sucks up and then it's like, there's this extra thing. It's like, no, 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 I don't want the at the end. It's and that's what makes it tight. I'm not being picky. I'm being particular because the cutoff is the cutoff. The attack is the attack. The time feel is the time feel. In the same way that the bridge goes to the four chord. I'm just as particular as the cutoff to me. So in a band that large, and if you're aiming for bullseyes as far as the tightness of a band, you can be particular about certain things. And it's not just being like, oh, I'm just picking on this person because they're new. Like, no. It's this thing wasn't right. You play the right note, but you just didn't let go of it at the right time.
I feel like there were teachers in my music career who were really harsh on me and I hated them at the time.
Yeah.
But now the standards that they put on me are the standards that I hold to myself and the musicians I work with. So I was like, were there teachers you worked with that taught you that intensity or how to bring it into the rehearsal room?
Yes. Kelly Taylor, Dave Britton, and Steve Palmer in the drumline world.
Yes. You started out in drumline, or maybe didn't start out, but you did a lot of drumline.
Marching band and drumline.
Yeah.
It's like, you guys aren't tight. It's like, what do you mean we're not tight? We're all playing the same thing. It's like, there's seven of you playing a snare drum that's going. If there's one person flamming, it's very obvious. And that attention to detail, I did not have in the beginning. And then eventually I learned to listen and focus on that level of attention to detail. And then I apply those things to other areas of music and other genres of music and other instruments. I mean, I applied all those drumline techniques to my guitar playing, just kind of why I have the thing that I have. And then in college, I had several teachers that were vicious about certain things, just knowing the fretboard. They'd quiz me on stuff. I'm like, oh, like if there's no it's like, where is, play me every C on the guitar right now. Boom, 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 boom. Okay, play every B flat that exists on the fretboard. There is no Do you know all the B flats or not? There's no So, you know, it was that sort of thing where I had to learn the fretboard that way. And then I started playing around in the Minneapolis music scene, which is, you know, a lot of the Prince camp. So there would be a lot of these bands that I play in where I was the only one who wasn't Prince alumni. And the drummer had perfect pitch and his time was insane. And he's a great producer, Michael Bland. And the bass player, Sonny Thompson, has perfect pitch, incredible arranger player. And all these other guys and girls that were around that were just had insane ears that could hear everything. They're just like, why are you playing that thick voicing? Like, what is that? Like, what do you mean? This is a G7. They're like, yeah, but why are you like, Prince wouldn't have played it like that. And, you know, part of my ego is like, well, yeah, whatever. Then hire Prince to come in. Could you? Yeah. Of course, I'm never going to say anything like that, you know. But it was that sort of attention to detail that they would get on me about, like, you're playing everything just a little bit too behind. You need to play a little more on top to lean it forward so it feels like there's more momentum. Or certain songs, pull back. It should feel more relaxed, this sort of thing, you know? And then there was this singing group called the Steels. Incredible sibling vocal group. Five singers that sound like 25 singers. And they could hear everything. So we were playing this stuff with really complex harmony. And anything that I played that would potentially clash with what they're doing vocally, they would hear every one of them. Just like, oh, as soon as I did something wrong, they'd all turn around and they'd know exactly who played what thing.
And Fred Steele said, like, no B flat, and the boys sing. And he just, you know, yell back, like, ah, I'm sorry, you know, so, and, you know, honestly, in the Minneapolis music scene, a lot of the Prince camp, it came from a school of negative reinforcement. So a lot of cats could not hang with that kind of thing. But it was just like, do you want it or not? So some of the Minneapolis thing was very much negative reinforcement. And part of it, the reason was, if we're railing on you about something, it's because we want you around. It's because you're good enough for us to be this adamant about it. If you're messing up and we're not, like, that's the classic Minneapolis thing. If somebody's playing and it's like, okay, it's like, hey, good job, man. Yeah, nice job. Ooh, you know, you're never going to see that person again. You know, I've seen that so many times. But if somebody's coming at you, it means, oh, okay, they probably want to see you again. And the next time they see you, they want it right. You know, that was my interpretation. And I took a beating and I'm okay taking that, you know, I knew it wasn't because they didn't like me or they just wanted to pick on me. It's because it was always about the excellence in the music. And this is where we're aiming on the dartboard. Hit it with us.
Did you have, because you started playing in this scene when you were in your really early 20s, right?
Yeah.
So was this scene easy to get your foot in? Like, could you just show up at the gig and sit in? And if you were good, they'd keep you around. Like, you must have had some excellence even in your really early 20s to have even been in the scene in the first place, right? Is that how you interpret it?
It was not easy to get in. I mean, you had to know folks. And, you know, at that point, I had been playing on a bunch of other gigs and sessions with some people that were in that scene. And then I would just kind of hang out. I would go watch the band. And they had their own arrangements of these tunes, but like the whole R&B funk catalog. And I was hanging for a while, and then eventually, oh yeah, this is the dude who was on that gig this last weekend that I was talking about. Oh, this is the cat from that session. I was telling you that guitar player who was really good, blah, blah, blah. Oh, cool. Yeah. Nice to see you, man. And then you show up a little bit more. And then at some point, hanging around for several months, I got invited up, you know, and it's not that way for everybody. I mean, I didn't want to assert myself into a situation where I wasn't invited. You know, I wanted to make sure that it was good on both sides.
Right. Corey, there's a scene in a documentary that's on YouTube. It's like a touring documentary. And the scene is you in a room with your entire horn section working on an arrangement for a tune.
I don't know if you know it, probably. Yeah.
Yes. And you, this is one of the examples that I'm just seeing how serious you are in the session, because they play the chart down and you go, that's not it. And they keep playing and they go, well, what do you think about that, Corey? And you go, well, that's my favorite thing I've heard so far. Like you're trying to get this arrangement together. I don't know if you remember that moment, but
of course I do. It was in the green room of Revolution Hall.
That sounds exactly right. The
code to get into that green room that night was 11011. Don't ask me why I remember.
Let's tell everyone. What were you looking for out of that arrangement, or how did you know it was right? Or just in general, like, what are you trying to accomplish with these horn arrangements? That, like, do you go in knowing what you're looking for and you just try to bring it there?
There's a certain emotion that I was looking for, and there was a certain momentum and a certain baton passing of the melody. And how the melody comes across. So Clair de Lune is traditionally a piano piece by Debussy. And there's some incredible versions out there. My favorite ones, the Philadelphia Orchestra one. There's a London Philharmonic. And there's a cut scene from the movie Fantasia. Incredible orchestral version of Clair de Lune. Also, Ocean's 11, the Bellagio fountain scene. Incredible arrangement of that tune. Several great arrangements of that tune. But those versions always gave me this very palpable emotional response. Like, it was a very visceral response to the music. And certain versions that I've heard of that song didn't give it to me, even though it's like my favorite piece of music of all time. I think it's like the most beautiful piece of music of all time. And I wanted that arrangement. If I'm going to do this tune that's kind of my favorite piece of music, I want it to come across in a certain way. And I think some of the way with five horns and some of them having to stick to certain roles, it wasn't accomplishing a certain rhythmic flow that felt like it was these waves that felt like they belonged together. Some of it just felt a little bit like it was segmented. Dum, dum, and then this thing, and then we do this thing, then we do this thing. And I wanted something that flowed together. And then when the melody passes from one person to the next, it's like, you shouldn't even notice. It should just feel like a wash. You should just hear the melody and almost not even recognize that it's a baton pass of who's doing it. And also there was just some, like that tune, it has the melody soaring over, it has the chord changes underneath, and then there's some rhythmic undercurrent that's happening that's usually like in the left hand moving along on the piano. And I just wasn't hearing it the right way. What's funny about the documentary is the original cut of the documentary, that section, I mean, we were in that room for 2 hours. And
wow,
Michael Bowden, who did the video, was laughing because he's like, dude, I don't know how I'm going to cut this down because there's so much good material. He's like, you should just release this as like a rehearsal.
That was my favorite part of the documentary. And I love the documentary, but that scene, I could have watched that scene for hours. I don't even know why. It was just it was just fascinating to see you guys work on it.
Yeah. And I mean, part of it, some of the way that we're talking in the documentary got, I'm speaking a little elusive and I'm not being very directional or not being actually very helpful in saying what I'm looking for or not looking for. In the room, I was saying very specific things like, oh, this triplet line doesn't feel like it has the right momentum if it's coming out of this eighth note line, or let's be a little more diligent in the time rather than having more of a rubato thing, have it feel a little more in time on this measure. And then this thing, change it to an eighth note, but just a kind of relaxed eighth note thing. You know, so I was getting into the very specifics of it, but not all of it was in the final cut of that.
Do you think you create an energy as a band leader that motivates people to want to work on an arrangement in the middle of tour, to be rehearsing for 2 hours on a new arrangement? Like, I can picture so many people driving them crazy. Like, we're in the middle of a tour, we're exhausted, we got a show tonight. Why are we spending hours working on this arrangement? But everyone in that room seem motivated to want to get it right. Do you think that's because they want to please your intensity and devotion to it? Like, is it something that you bring as a band leader that you think motivates people to want to spend so much time on an arrangement like that? Or maybe they were pissed. I don't know.
It would be lovely for me to be able to say, oh yes, they love my artistry and my blah, blah, blah. And oh yeah, they want to make sure that I'm so satisfied. Yeah, that would be cute to say. But I think the reality is, any good band leader, any good producer of an album is also a very good casting director. And part of my job as a band leader is to be a casting director of people who are going to have a dedication to excellence in their craft and are going to want to, if they're going to do something, they want to do it the absolute best that they can and at the highest level, arguably, that is existing in music today. And fortunately, I have a horn arranger in my band, Michael Nelson, who is a brilliant arranger. I mean, all the dope Prince horn arrangements you've heard. I mean, that's how I found these cats, is through the Prince camp, you know? So Michael's done insane horn arrangements all around, and he's very meticulous. He's very, very meticulous. And that's because he has a dedication to the music, and it's not just to piss off the other horn players. You know, we will be in the middle of a tour. And he's like, we were playing this last night and something about this voicing didn't feel right. I made it, update your iPads. There's a new chart in the Dropbox. It's like, oh, everything's the same except for like these two little notes. You know, he's very meticulous, and I respect and appreciate that because his attention to detail is what helps this band to feel so tight. And the players in my band, it's pretty much a requirement that you are going to bring a level of excellence that I don't even have to ask for, that the cast just want to do the best thing that they can for the music and get excited by feeling like they're absolutely nailing something at the highest level.
But do you think they feel that way because you always nail it, and because you're spending so much time to make sure your parts are nailed that they have to live up to it? Like, there must be some energy you're putting out that motivates them to respond in the way that you're describing.
Yeah, I think any good leader needs to to not just say, oh, you guys do this and then I slough off. You know, I am harder on myself than I am on them. And I don't always verbalize it, but I definitely, I'm okay acknowledging it, you know, and I, there's certain things that I'm aware of in my playing that are very easy for me. And there's certain things that are harder and certain things that I'm just not the right person for and certain things that I am. And I acknowledge that and have the humility to just be okay with it, but also, you know, understand my strengths, lean into those as part of my artistry, which is what I do. So I think having that sort of mindset and holding myself to a certain standard, absolutely, kind of goes without saying, but yes, because I hold myself to a certain standard, I am maybe given permission to hold everybody else to that standard as well, which wouldn't be the case. I've been in certain bands where leaders will try to hold some of the band members to a certain standard, but then don't for themselves. It's like, eh.
It doesn't really work. How you did on, I think it was your last European tour, you had a bassist come into that tour like 7 hours before your first show.
Yeah.
It seems like you had no rehearsals or anything. How hard is it to come into this band as a bass player with, you know, 48 hours notice? And were you blown away by this guy? Because to me, he sounded like he had been playing with you guys for years. Like, he sounded unbelievable to me. What was that like to pull that guy in hours before the gig?
Anybody in my band will tell you the hardest position in my band is the bass or the drums, because I'm very particular about those things, about the time field, the releases of notes, the attacks, how we're interweaving with each other, because I'm a lead rhythm guitar player at my core. So I'm in the rhythm section, but I'm also playing lead things. And there's certain stuff that I do that people might not, they might try to weave above or in or out of it. And a lot of the parts are very intentional on how they work together. So the bass position in my band is a very hard one to come into. And what happened is Sonny T, who was supposed to come on the tour, there was some sickness in his family. He wasn't able to leave town for the tour. And I remembered 5 years ago, there was this cat, Vincent Garcia, who sent me a message saying, hey, dude, if you ever need a bass player in Europe, I'm your cat. And, you know, the other couple people who have played with me before were unavailable. And I remembered that DM that he sent. And I mean, I followed the guy ever since. He's an incredible bass player. I was like, all right. He said he wanted the gig, so I'm going to send him a message. He's like, dude, I don't speak English. I'll talk to my friend, like, but yes, I want to play. And eventually, you know, it worked out being great. I said, all right, over the course of the tour starts in one day. Like, you got to fly up to Sweden. I'm leaving tonight to fly to Sweden. He's leaving from Spain the next morning. And here's the 40 songs that we're going to do over the course of the tour. Here's the set list for night one and the set list for night two. Prioritize these. There will be a lot of overlap just to make sure that you're good. Let me know if you have any questions. Here's boom, 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 some specifics about certain tunes where I know there's pressure points as a bass player, and, or like, you know, what could be interpreted or what's written in stone. And I trusted that he was going to come to the table correct. I knew all the technical facility, all the chops is there, and I knew he had the tone. I knew that he had the feel. I didn't know that he had the feel. I wasn't sure, because a European funk thing and the American funk thing, it can feel different if somebody grew up playing a lot of jazz and jazz fusion in Europe, or if they didn't grow up playing R&B in Europe.
What's the difference? Where they feel on the beat, if they're behind it or ahead of it, or like, how can you define the difference, or it's hard to define?
Yeah, it's just some of the releases take a little longer to let go of. Some of the stuff is just more open sounding than tight. A lot of the tones are more distorted than they need to be. A lot of the tones are, like, drum tone wise, it's like the hats are just a little bit too open. The kick and snare are a little too open or rocky. Some of the stuff feels a little more rock derived than actual R&B. Lineage into funk, because there's many paths to the modern funk thing. A lot of the stuff a lot of European players sound like it comes more from a rock and jazz lineage rather than jazz fusion. And a lot of the American R&B, it's rooted in, or a lot of the American funk stuff, the way that we feel time, it's rooted more in actually just the R&B side of things, and R&B pop, funk, Earth, Wind & Fire, Ohio Players, Sly, Funkadelic, that sort of stuff. And different versions of that, you know. But Vincent came into the gig. Basically, we kind of jammed on a chord for a while. And I was like, all right, here's some time feel things. Like, you know the tunes as well as you're going to know them at this point. But there's some stuff when we get locking in a groove, we had to learn to negotiate how we're placing the time and attacks and releases. And I was like, the first couple of days, if you need to use some cheat sheets on stage on a music stand, that's fine. By the third gig, just go memorized. And he really put in the work.
He sounded unbelievable. Like,
he's insane. He's so dope. I mean, he's ridiculous. He's so good.
And were you really struggling to communicate with him because did he literally not speak English? Or were you able to speak a little bit of English with him?
He could speak some English. It actually got better over the course of the tour. Because, I mean, he just doesn't practice it a lot.
Yeah.
You know, so I know a little bit of Spanish. A couple of the guys in the band know a little bit of Spanish. And his English was good enough where it was.
He must have felt like a boss pulling that off. I'm sure that felt great for him.
Oh, dude.
Yeah. I'm sure it was a huge ego thing. Okay, I know we're running out of time here. Corey, I want to ask you, your signature Strat has this smaller body, which you say helps with the transience of the guitar.
Right here.
How did you stumble upon that? Like, how did you figure that out?
A hunch. I had a hunch.
Really?
No. Well, I had a hunch and some backing. Okay. I played a lot of Strats in my day. Okay. I played a lot of S-style guitars.
Yeah.
Right? Every guitar company has some S-style guitar. And I noticed some of them felt a little bit smaller than my regular Strat. And they had a certain snap to the attack. So for those listening, the transient is basically right when it hits. The very first thing that you hear, the attack of the note. I felt like some of these S-style guitars that had a little less wood in the body has had a certain snap to them. And I was like, I'm not crazy in this. I know it because I played a bunch of Strats and I know a Strat. Okay. And when we were talking about doing the signature guitar, anything you want, let us know. It's like, I want a body. Hear me out. It feels like, you know, the contoured neck and blah, 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 some of the modern features for comfort and all this stuff. The body, I want it to be like 3% smaller than a regular Strat. And just basically, whoever's sanding the guitar, have them sand it for an extra 10 minutes, you know? Or whatever. They're like, it doesn't quite work. Like we're going to have to do a new mold and blah, blah, blah. Like, I don't think we're going to do it.
They're cursing your name at the water cooler. They're like, Corey Walling is making us.
Seriously,
new Strat bodies. Who's he think he is?
We're going to have to machine new parts to make this thing. Really?
Yeah.
I was like, I swear, like, please, you don't have to machine the parts. Just start by giving me one that you've just sanded 10, 15 minutes longer than all the others. And they're like, And then at the same time, Nile Rodgers is working on a remake, note for note remake of his Hitmaker guitar. And they send him one. They're like, from you giving us the serial number, we know exactly what day on the factory it was made, blah, blah, blah. Everything's the exact same. They send it to him. They're like, we nailed it. This is exactly it. Exactly to spec. He's like, this thing's bigger than my guitar. They're like, no, it's not. It's exactly the spec. He's like, I've been playing this guitar for decades and I'm looking at them. And this one that you made is bigger. I need it to be smaller. It doesn't have the same attack. Completely independent of what I was saying to Fender. So they're like, huh, really? It's like Doris took a smoke break after sanding his guitar, forgot how long she was sanding the guitar, came back and just sanded it from start. And it was his model, his whatever he has, happens to be a little bit smaller because it just got sanded longer. So Fender was finally like, the two rhythm cats want their guitars a little smaller because they think that it changes the attack. Maybe they're not crazy. All right, we'll try it. They did it, and they're like, oh my gosh, you're right. But, you know, a little bit of a hunch, a little bit of scientific method. I was glad that Niall did this completely independent of me.
Yeah.
Because at the time, Niall and I didn't even know each other. So we couldn't have schemed this up together. And they ended up making it. And now it's exactly the guitar I want.
That's such a great story. I heard you mention a couple times this one session that you did with Blake Shelton. And I've tried to find the credits, and I couldn't find the credits online. What was the session that you did for Blake Shelton?
Let me try to find it. I played on a Blake Shelton tune. I played on a Florida Georgia Line song. I had like a envelope filter. Let me see. I think it was produced by, let me see, Chris Stevens, maybe?
Did it ever get released?
Oh, I'm sure it did. This song was killing. I remember that. My emails are not going back far enough, I don't think. This must have been in 2015.
Was it in Nashville, though? Like, how'd you get the call for it?
Yeah, it was in Nashville. I mean, for a while, I was in Nashville doing a lot of session work, and I still do some stuff here and there. But when I was playing guitar in Ben Rector's band, I was splitting my time between Nashville and Minneapolis and actually spending more time in Nashville. I'm still in Nashville a lot, but why can't I find this? I feel like it was Days. The word Days was in there. It was a Nashville session. I'm pretty sure it was with Chris Stevens. I know it was.
Yeah.
He's a producer.
Is there anything memorable to talk about, or was it just another day in the office, or like, was
No, this was, I mean, nobody cared about me as a guitar player at the time, like my thing. It was just like, we need guitar. Chorus comes. Bang.
Just diamonds. They had you come in and do diamonds, all
right,
basically.
All right, same thing. Pan it left. Put the other one right. All right, like, what else you got? And then I'd play some stuff like, oh, that's kind of cool. That's not what other people in Nashville do. Like, all right. And cool, like, this is what I'm hearing on the tune.
Yeah.
And then it was cool.
I'd love to. I bet that was a cool session.
I gotta find it. I'm sure I have a bounce of it somewhere. I'll email Chris and ask him.
Okay, I'm wrapping up here. First of all, I want to ask you, there's an episode of your podcast where you interviewed Steve Vai.
Yeah.
And he was so complimentary of your playing. Did that really freak you out? I mean, you guys are in totally different worlds, but I feel like if Steve was saying that about my playing, it would have so much weight. Did that really mean a lot to you, or was it kind of like, okay, you know?
Yeah. No, I'm absolutely. I mean, he even said in some magazine, it was like five young guitar players you have to listen to. You know, he put me on the list. It's like, wow. I mean, yeah, this is this sort of thing. I've been very fortunate. Many of my heroes have become fans of my playing, and I don't take it for granted at all. And, you know, I'm humbled by it. I'm flattered. But also, I think the thing about it is that I'm doing something that's uniquely my voice on the instrument. And I think that's really the thing that people are stoked about, and kind of really making rhythm guitar a lead thing and bringing attention to the importance of rhythm guitar. Of course, I play lead guitar all the time, but people know me for the rhythm stuff. And I think that's the thing that garners the attention of a lot of our heroes, is that they recognize that I'm doing something in a lane that has not really been celebrated or explored a lot, and that I find true joy and artistry in it.
Do you feel like it's such a gift to have developed this signature thing? Because I feel like there are tons of incredible, amazing guitar players that are unbelievable, but they don't have this like signature thing, and they might never find it. Like, do you feel like what a gift it is that I have this thing that I've developed?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. That works for me.
Yeah, it's insane. I obviously worked for it. And I had a lot of awareness that I needed to be cognizant of. And a lot of people around me also that were just like, this is your thing. Like, oh, what aspect of it? Well, that's the thing that you do. And then I started to develop it and kind of hone in on something that fortunately was very fun to do and came very easy to me as well, which I think is the case for a lot of people that really find their voice. It actually is a lot easier to do for them than they think.
When you think about the Corey Wong business and the operation, let's say on a scale from like Joe Bonamassa talks about being fully vertically integrated, he promotes his own shows.
Yeah.
And then whatever the other side of that scale is, where is your business and career fall in between those? Like, are do you do everything in house or not some, or like what does it look like from a brief overview?
Live wise, I work with promoters and have agents and, you know, run in the industry. But when it comes to making records, I'm completely independent. I do it all myself. And I mean, I have managers that help me with my career, and I use DistroKid for my distribution. But, you know, I don't have a label. I think being an independent artist is a fun thing. I would totally be down to be on a label. I'd love to be on a label if it was the right
deal,
if it felt good. Yeah. If it felt good.
Yeah.
And it felt like it was a really symbiotic relationship, of course.
Interesting. Okay.
I mean, I've been in the indie for so long. I'm totally down to try. Like, let's give it two albums. Let's see what happens. Let's see what we can do for and with each other.
I feel like I would love putting out music at the rate that you put out music, though, if I was you.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't want anyone telling me what to do. But for two albums, you could deal with it,
that's
basically.
That's what I'm saying. Two albums.
Yeah. Let's see. Let's just see what could. But what do you think they would bring to the table that you don't have right now? Like a level of PR or something?
Yeah, PR, network, their marketing team, you know, all the general industry stuff.
Okay.
The zeitgeist things.
Yeah. You know. Fair enough. Okay, Corey, before we wrap up, can I totally put you on the spot? You can say no, and I'll cut this out, and I won't be offended. Could you give us like one lick? You've got a million guitars behind you. Can you give us like one, maybe like a triplet thing that you always do, or like some lick that we could go home and learn and like really break down? It doesn't have to be long. Something short that we could go home and really understand.
Can you hear this?
No, unfortunately not.
How about this?
Oh, I wish I could. Would the acoustic be better? Yeah.
One little lick.
One lick.
Then I gotta go. Minnesota Wild home opener tonight.
Oh my God. I don't even know what that is. A Wild home opener?
The Minnesota Wild home opener. The Minnesota Wild is our hockey team.
Oh, see, I'm just so not a sports person.
A7.
Brilliant.
There you go.
That's the lick. Corey, dude, thank you so much for taking the time. From an Instagram DM, he said earlier he doesn't take on a lot of things, and I am honored
you said yes
to this.
I said yes.
You said yes. You guys shoot the shot. Really appreciate it, Corey. It's great to see you, man.
Yeah, but maybe you're in Nashville, right?
I'm in Nashville, yep.
Come hang. I'm playing at the Ryman at the end of the month.
Dude, I'm there. What do I do?
The 30th and 31st.
I'm there of October.
Yep. You got my number.
Dude,
we'll
there.
Connect.